notice of the agenda, three work sessions and then four bills for public hearing and possible work session. All three of those work sessions, Senate Bill 279, Senate Bill 347A, and Senate Bill 629A, those will be not be worked today. They will be rolled over to our next committee day, which is Tuesday, the 29th of May, because we will not be meeting tomorrow, and with the we're not in the building on Monday. So that those are rolled to Tuesday, the 29th. We will be hearing these other four bills, and we're going to take them in by starting out with Senate Bill 345 and moving to Senate Bill 406, and then most likely to Senate Bill 248 based on the scheduling of one of the witnesses for that bill. So I'll start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 345A. Council Kelmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 345A requires a judgment creditor who seeks a sale of real property under a writ of execution to provide the sheriff a list of all interests of record in the property. It requires the sheriff to include in the notice of sale the list of interests in the property. It also requires the judgment creditor to provide the sheriff a title report issued within 10 days before the date of the sale, which the sheriff must make available to bidders who appear at the sale. There are also amendments, the Dash A4 amendments, which were before the committee. What the Dash A4 bills would do is remove all the requirements that I just described except for the title report requirement. So if the committee was to adopt the A4s, it would require a judgment creditor to provide the sheriff a title report within 10 days before the sale, and the sheriff would have to make that available to the bidders who appear at the sale.
Very good. Senator Prusansky.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Floyd Prusansky, State Senator, District 4. Mr. Chair, I understand there's another individual maybe from the OSB, Mr. Bell. And if you would like to go ahead and call him up, that's fine with me. I know that we're taking different positions. There may be questions
if Bell, the committee may want to. Come on up as well.
Mr. Chair, if it's all right, I'll go ahead and get started.
Very good.
Committee, the bill that you have before you, SB 345, is a bill that came to my attention, or the issue came to my attention based on a constituent having the reality of learning, let's say, through the School of Hard Knocks, as he has stated, how foreclosure sales work in this state. And what I'm asking this committee to do is to make it a little bit more disclosing as to those consumers who are attempting to purchase land as to exactly what they are buying before they actually get into that process. For Mr. Crump, my constituent, what happened to him is about a year or so back, he saw an ad that was in the local paper that basically said that there was a piece of property that was for sale. It was noticed that the lien was with the Bank of America and lists the debt about $30,000. He went by that property two or three different times and realized that it looked like it could be a pretty decent purchase to make for investment purposes. And he also knew at the time that there may be some other liens on the property. At the time of the sale, after deciding that he was going to go there and be one of the people that would be bidding on the property, he took with him in excess of $100,000 in credit cashier's checks as well as cash to be sure that he could comply with the requirements. It turned out very quickly that that they sized up the group. There's about 20 people there. There was the sheriff that opened the auction and made a formal statement. The statement was basically telling the buyer to beware and alluded to that the property was having some other debt. At the time that the deputy made that statement, there was an officer for the Bank of America representing the bank standing next to him. Mr. Crump asked a question, and the question was directed to both of them as to what other debt are they referring to. He received no answer, and the bid began. It turned out as the bidding started off, he realized that he and one other person were the ones that were really most interested in the property because they were bidding against each other. At some point, somewhere in the range of when they were bidding in about $500 increments, they got up to the point of where he won the bid for $48,000. And at that point, that was approximately $18,000 over what the property was listed for and the indebtedness that the bank claimed. After that occurred, someone came up to him and mentioned to him that they had heard that the property actually had more debt by the same bank, the Bank of America, that was in excess or close to $170,000. He was not informed of this, of course, when he asked the question before the bidding began, where there was even a representative of the bank standing next to the deputy conducting the sale. What he learned after that was he was told that he could make inquiries of the bank by calling their representative to find out exactly what was going on. That is where it was confirmed after he went over, deposited the money, because he thought at that point he didn't know what to believe, where he stood, and he didn't know if he had a good deal or if he just got suckered. But after he made the deposits, that's when he got the information about who he could contact about the property. When he made the contact, it was confirmed that the Bank of America, the one that was selling the second, that was before out for public notice, had the first of $176,000 plus interest. At that point, he knew that he had been, in his opinion, scammed. And I would say that I think it was scammed, too, because he asked a question that was a legitimate question of the bank rep that was standing there at the time of the sale, and before the bidding began, they refused to answer that question. What we are asking this committee to do is basically require two notices. The first notice would be at the time of the legal notification going into the paper on a foreclosure sale to require the individual to list all known debts that are known to the individual that's attempting to sell whatever or foreclosing on whatever lien that they have out there. Clearly, the individual who is making that type of sale may not know each and every debt that is against the property because some are recorded and some are not. We expect that the only obligation that a person would have is to list what they know at the time that the notice goes in to the paper. These legal notifications are usually 60 days plus out from the date of the sale. And so we also realize that things can occur between that 60 days or the notice and the time of the sale. The most important part, I believe, is the second part, and that is the part where an individual, when the time of the sale is going to occur, should be able to get information from the sheriff's office as well as from the representative of the lien holder as to what is actually assessed and what are the liens that are against that property. To accomplish that, we're asking the committee to require the person who wants to sell that property to submit to the sheriff's office 10 days prior to the sale, or less than 10 days prior to the sale, a title report. Now, it would not be a final title report. It would be a preliminary title report. But what we would know is at that point in time, for any of our constituents who went to one of these type of sales, they would be able to ask the deputy, I would like to see the title report. And that would be one that's close in time, again, within 10 days of the sale, and they would know before the bidding even began what other encumbrances had been recorded against that property. I understand from the chair and council that you do have the A4s before you that would, in fact, accomplish the second part of this. Clearly, I believe that it would be appropriate to require both steps of notification for the notice that would go into the newspaper as well as having the title report, but clearly understand that if this committee thinks that the A4s is the best way to go, at least having the title report available that would reflect the liens within the 10 days prior to the sale. My constituent, I believe, would accept that, and I will accept that because at least we know it's better than what we have now and that there would, in fact, be notice. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for Senator Brzozinski? Or Senator Barker?
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. I was just in, just kind of thinking this over, it would seem like if we could set some kind of a minimum price differential. If I'm bidding on something I think is $100,000 and it turns out to be like $110,000, okay. But if it's more than that, I should be able to walk from that, from my bid. Something to protect the buyer, that what you're obviously trying to do. So that if a title, even like a 10-day title, like you say, might not be the last word. Well, if it said $48,000 and then it turns out to be $170,000, I should be able to walk away at no penalty and not have to pay all the fees that your constituent had to pay.
Chair and Representative Barker, I hear what you're saying. I tell you, I think there's an issue here. We're not here to change real estate law, and there is a means for people to register or record the liens that they have. And there is a buyer beware in all of this, and there are individuals who may not register or record their liens. I would assume for the most part those individuals have very small liens or amounts of money of debt that they just have, whatever reason, have not recorded. Plus, there's in business, there are in fact types of liens that are not normally recorded, such as if there had been some type of mechanics lien or some type of remodeling or construction lien. And those are a supplier's lien for a product that had been delivered to the house. And as much as I respect that, I think that's a bigger step than I would request at this time, and think that at least the notice of what we have on that's recorded would be a nice first step, and then we can see if it needs to be monitored later.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wisnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, your constituent, is this a one-time buy for him? Does he do this frequently? And did he get any satisfaction in this issue?
This was what I would consider a one-time buy. This was his first experience. As he says, welcome to the School of Hard Knocks. He did get satisfaction, and I'll explain what that satisfaction is. When he contacted me, I contacted the representative for the banking institutions. We then had a conversation with the Bank of America. It took some time, and he actually had an attorney who was representing him, and they went back and forth for some period of time. He ended up paying, I believe, about $8,000 to the bank to allow them to recover their cost of going through the process of setting up the sheriff's sale. And so, as he stated, it was an expensive but a lesson that he's learned. And what I would tell you is that there's not one of us in this room that is an elected official who could not, who would not be able to say they could have a constituent come to them with this type of an issue. And what we're trying to do is make sure business can work fluidly, that it does not hinder the business from conducting and having these type of sales to take care of their liens that they want to foreclose on. But I really find it unconscionable that you have a bank representative standing there at the cell, a question's asked, and they will not answer that question. And we have individuals who are not as intelligent, maybe, as a person that's involved in this type of business on a day-in and day-out basis. And many of these individuals that are, they understand that how they can go through, get a title report. Mr. Crump makes reference that it would cost $300 to $400 to do a full title search. I'm not sure what the full cost would be. Well, I think what we're trying to do is find some middle ground here to give a little bit more protection for the unknown buyer of something that we would think would be logical. You'd expect that if you ask someone of authority what is the other lien or debt they're talking about, that they'd be forthright. And in this case, they don't have to be. They can sit on that information, and if they can catch on in this, they can do that. In this case, it cost them about $8,000. It was a lesson that he's learned, and I think he's much more aware. But I would think that having at least the A4s would protect people going into these sales. At least they would be able to ask for it and see it then.
Thank you.
Any further questions for the Senator? Let's hear from Mr. Bell. And Senator, if you have the time to wait and see, so you can hear what we get, that might be useful. Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning before you concerning Senate Bill 345. My name is Aaron Bell. I'm a practicing attorney. I have my office in Canby, Oregon. I'm licensed to practice in both Oregon and Washington, and I've represented creditors primarily in that practice over the course of the last 15, 17 years now. This is a circumstance where bad facts will make a bad law. I don't dispute the facts as recited by Senator Przanski, but I've spoken with the attorney who represented the creditor, and there's a little bit more to add. In addition to the fact that this was the first time that Senator Przanski's constituent had bid at a sale, he conducted no investigation in advance of the sale. This was a sale at which the bank was represented by a process server. Under the law, the creditor is not required to be represented by an attorney or a creditor, a specific representative or an employee of the bank or a creditor. In this instance, as occurs in most instances, the creditor will send a process server or a representative from a local title insurance company or someone else just to appear and present the bid. that person won't know anything other than what's on the piece of paper that's handed to them, and all that that shows is what the creditor's bid is for that particular sale. That's what occurred in this instance. And in addition, this was the deputy sheriff's first foreclosure sale as well. Out of those, that set of facts, then, we have a circumstance where we're trying to make a law to protect all first-time bidders at a foreclosure sale, and it's not necessary, and Senate Bill 345, as it's presented, is inappropriate for the following reasons. A title report is a specific product that's produced by a title insurance company. And this bill would require the creditor to provide to the sheriff a title report issued within 10 days of the sale. In every single foreclosure circumstance that I can think of, I don't buy a title report. I buy, at the outset of the process, a foreclosure guarantee from the title insurance company. And then a short time before the sale, I'll obtain an endorsement or an update of that foreclosure guarantee just to make sure that no intervening liens have attached to the property prior to my sale. We won't ever acquire a title report, and I am confident, given the conversations I've had with other members of my committee, that most creditors don't acquire a title report. So this would require creditors to buy something new that isn't customarily purchased as a part of the foreclosure process. The bill unfairly puts the burden of obtaining correct title information on the judgment creditor. Mind you, this is a circumstance where someone wants to show up at a foreclosure sale and buy a piece of real property. And for that person to show up at that sale without having conducted their own due diligence concerning, for example, the title, the condition of the title, the environmental condition of the property, zoning restrictions, and so on, is reckless. And that burden should not be shifted to the judgment creditor merely because the potential bidder, is being reckless. There are some things that could arise from shifting that burden that the bill doesn't address. For example, the extent of the judgment creditor's liability. It's not unheard of to have a title report miss certain liens on the property. And potentially, that bidder then could have a cause of action against the creditor, who merely was trying to provide the report required by the bill, or have liability imposed upon the title insurance company, who didn't even insure title for that bidder. Those are two problems that aren't addressed by the bill. In addition, ORS 18.932 allows postponement of the sale by the sheriff. And what oftentimes will occur is a hitch will arise in either the process of the sale or something will come up on the date of the sale, and the sheriff will postpone the sale at the time of the sale. There can be multiple postponements over the period of time that the writ of execution authorizing the sale is valid. And under this bill, each time the sale is postponed and rescheduled, the creditor would be required to provide a title insurance report to the sheriff 10 days prior to the date of the sale. The bill will create extra costs that must be borne by the debtor. Most of the time, the creditor will recover their costs of the foreclosure from the proceeds of the sale. But under the law, the debtor is authorized to redeem the property by paying back to the creditor what the creditor is owed, plus all of the costs of that sale. So what will be happening here is that the cost of the title report will be passed through to the debtor and will have to be repaid by the debtor in order to get their property back. We don't think that Senate Bill 345 is a fair allocation of risk. We think that the onus should be on the potential bidder to do their own investigation and own due diligence prior to the sale, satisfy themselves that this is the property they want to bid on, and that burden shouldn't be shifted to the creditor. And for those reasons, we request that you not pass on Senate Bill 345. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bell, in this circumstance, you heard the senator tell what happened to his constituent. And it seems particularly egregious because he asked if there was other debt. Can you think of a way, short of providing a title report, which does involve cost, to require disclosure? Even if it's an agent, you said it was a process server, couldn't the creditors give that agent or representative information about known encumbrances to pass along? I'm looking for a way to solve this that might not involve that additional debt, but we have to. He asked specifically if there was debt and was not told.
Chair McPherson and Representative Bonamici, the short answer is yes. But as a practical matter, what happens is potential bidders will contact either the attorney or the creditor well in advance of the sale and ask those kinds of questions. Oftentimes, creditors won't be willing to share their insurance product because that title insurance product or that foreclosure guarantee is specifically a policy issued for the creditor. And most creditors' attorneys will advise their clients not to share that policy for fear, again, of making representations to the potential bidder of the status of the title. If that potential bidder wants to find out the status in advance, there are products that you can buy, a bidder can buy. And ultimately, that bidder is going to have to buy their own title insurance policy anyway if they're successful at the sale. So, yes, the creditor could provide their title insurance product to the person who appears at the sale. As a practical matter, it doesn't happen because most of the due diligence is done well in advance of the sale. Does that answer your question?
And follow up?
Go ahead.
So it's my understanding, based on what you said then, that the creditor already has some sort of policy.
The creditor will acquire at the outset of the foreclosure process a guarantee from the title company, and that guarantee will then provide to them a list of all liens on the property. In order to accomplish the foreclosure, the creditor is required to provide notice to all liens that are junior to the interest that's being foreclosed. And that guarantee then is a guarantee of the existence of those junior liens that provides then the manuals, if you will, for the creditor to follow in accomplishing their foreclosure. But that will occur, like I say, at the outset. There may be, depending on the type of foreclosure process, there could be up to a year between the time of the acquisition of the guarantee and the time that the actual sale occurs. And so what you do as a creditor is, just prior to the sale, you obtain an endorsement. You contact the title insurance company and you ask them to give you an update or an endorsement on the policy that tells you what liens may have attached in that intervening period.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bell, thanks. So if Mr. Crump was going to go and do this all over again, is there some training? I mean, as an individual citizen, I wanted to start going and looking at foreclosures as obviously there's some value there, but obviously to get that value, I've got to do some work and put in the effort. What would you advise me or Mr. Crump to do? Can you give us some practical things, like tomorrow if we saw a notice in the paper, what would be the first thing that you would advise me to do?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, if the deal looks too good to be true, it probably is.
How do I discover that?
Well,
the
reason that most folks will show up at a foreclosure sale and bid, particularly if they've never done it before, is they think the property has a significant value far in excess of what appears to be owed. And I would encourage bidders, and most do, to contact the creditor. They are given notice 4 weeks, at least 4 weeks in advance of the sale. The sheriff is required to publish that notice of sale 4 successive weeks in a paper of general circulation in the county where the property lies. So they'll have notice well in advance of the sale. They should contact the creditor, whose name and most of the time telephone number and contact information is contained in the notice. They should contact that creditor or representative, find out in advance what liens may exist, find out what they're buying, and do some due diligence, just as you would if you were buying a piece of real property from me off the street.
Well, follow up if I may. So in this particular case, if I contacted Bank America 4 weeks in advance, what would Bank America tell me? And what would they, first of all, what would they legally have to tell me, and what would they tell me? And go ahead, answer that one first. I got another one.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, what would they legally be required to tell you? Nothing.
Okay, next question. Now you're advising me, because I'm learning how to do this. What's my next thing I do if they don't tell me anything?
Then you inquire of a title insurance company concerning a title product for yourself. If you are still intending to appear at that sale, you should find out what sort of insurance product you can acquire, or what a title report will cost you, or even what's called a lot book report could cost you. That will give you a vague idea of what liens might exist against the property, or I guess a lot book report wouldn't, but a title report definitely would tell you what liens exist against the property. And I think that's, I don't know for sure, but I think that has a nominal cost.
Sure. So, okay, so if I went to a title company and says, I've got this property, I'm interested in a title report on it, would that other Bank of America loan show up at that time when I receive that title report?
Yes, it would.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? So, Mr. Bell, I think what I'm understanding is that the way the law is now, it's buyer beware. That is, the potential purchaser who is interested in making a purchase at a foreclosure sale, they can make inquiry, but the creditor who put it up for foreclosure sale is undertaking the foreclosure has no legal duty to give them accurate information or to respond at all. So that to be safe, that purchaser has to go out and get a title report in preparation for buying a title policy him or herself. I assume that purchase occurring only if it were successful, that is, they got the winning bid. Am I right so far?
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right.
And would that be a typical thing to do? I mean, obviously, you'd try to find out as much as you could just before you invested that time and energy through informal inquiry. But then after you'd undertaken that, then you'd have to get a title report before you go to make the foreclosure sale to put in your bid. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And I think the way title insurance ordinarily works is you get a title report, a preliminary title report, before the closing, and then typically and then you determine whether there's clear title to make the purchase, and then as a part of the closing, the title insurance is purchased and a premium paid. When does that occur in a foreclosure situation? Like if the purchaser is doing all this for his own protection, then when does he actually make that purchase of a title policy?
Mr. Chair, that would occur at any point along the course of the foreclosure process where the bidder got involved. I've seen it occur either at the time that the potential bidder is doing their own due diligence. They'll go through, oftentimes, they'll go through a litany of due diligence items. They will contact the creditor. They'll find out what they can. Oftentimes, they'll request a copy of the foreclosure guarantee or a portion of it that will show junior liens. They may have their own contacts at a title insurance company and get some special products that I'm unaware of, but I've heard of those at foreclosure sales. The bidder ultimately won't obtain a title guarantee until after they have purchased the property. until after they have become the successful bidder. And even at that point, I don't know that it would do them any good to get a guarantee. They would have already purchased the property. Now, the way the foreclosure process works is, if you're the successful bidder at the sale, you get a sheriff's certificate. And it says you were the successful bidder at the sale. But oftentimes there'll be a period of redemption, a period where the debtor can come back and redeem the property by paying back what the creditor was owed plus the cost of the sale and so on and so on. So once that redemption period then expires, actual title, a deed then is passed to the buyer. So the buyer at the sale can determine any step of the way along the way at what point they actually want to get a guarantee from a title insurance company concerning their title.
Okay, but all of that burden or obligation falls on the purchaser for the purchaser's protection, and what the effect of Senate Bill 345 would shift that to the creditor who's putting the property up for foreclosure sale. Both as to an advance notice about the condition of title before the sale, and at the time of sale, then a notice about what the condition of title is. Am I understanding it correctly?
Mr. Chair, that's exactly correct. Okay. Now, as an alternative, if you will, I think maybe I even threw this out at the time that I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, the notice that's published could, in fact, provide a buyer beware disclaimer. It could say, in bold print of a certain type size, the lien that's being foreclosed may not be a first lien, or there may be other impairments to the property. The obligation is on you as a potential bidder to conduct your own due diligence in advance of the sale. Something to that effect. That then wouldn't shift the burden to the creditor unfairly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of follow-up questions. Apparently what happened to the senator's constituent, and what concerns me about this particular case is that you're saying he should ask questions. Well, he did ask questions. He didn't ask them before, but he asked them there. He said, what kind of debt are you referring to? And you said there may be another debt, and he didn't get an answer. So that's what concerns me so much, is that he specifically asked. But I wonder, in how many situations is it an agent? You said it was a process server. Is there somebody like that there who might not have the information? And did anybody ever tell him that this was a second mortgage and that he didn't find out until later that there was a first? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bonamici, with regard to your first question, it's very common to have a representative of the creditor at the foreclosure sale who might not know anything about the debt, who might not know anything about the status of the title, who only has in their hand the bid sheet that's produced by the creditor in advance of the sale that says on it what the creditor is owed and the maximum amount that the representative is authorized to bid. That's it. And most of the time that's to save expense, and most of the time you'll do that when there is someone that you can hire who is local to the county courthouse where the sale is occurring to show up and appear so that you don't have to travel to the sale. That person isn't authorized to dispense legal advice, so you don't need to have an attorney there. With regard to your second question, I don't know. As Senator Przonski said in his testimony, the sheriff, I believe, specifically disclosed the fact that there may be other liens against the property at the time of the sale. And anything further, I don't know.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Committee, what I would suggest is that we close the public hearing, not take this to work session today. Have an opportunity to consider some of the variations here. We have the Dash A4 amendments that would take out the advance notice requirement, retain a notice requirement, or title notice requirement for the sale. Got a suggestion that it ought to be sufficient if there's a disclaimer put in a notice. And what we have an opportunity for discussion, consideration of those issues. Senator Przonski?
Mr. Chair, that's fine with myself and what my creditor or my constituent would want. Let me just give two closings from what Mr. Bell said. Maybe the term that I've used I do prosecution. I don't do real estate law, so I don't know all the term of art. And we've heard a lot about title insurance products, special products, and stuff like that. What we know from what Mr. Bell says a creditor does, though, is they get a foreclosure guarantee, and then they get an endorsement just before the sale. And maybe that's what we need to do, is maybe we need to wordsmith this to that point, because that is something that the creditor is already doing. It's not going to be an additional cost. It's just going to require them to share it. The part that bothers me is that you send a process server that's ignorant, then you purposely can have them go in there dumb to not answer any questions. And then, if, as we've heard from Representative Cameron's question, you call up the creditor. What's their legal obligation to tell you? Nothing. And they're telling their clients to be silent because they don't want to take on other liability. I think there's a way that we can do this, give a little bit more disclosure, and it's not going to be an overwhelming cost or burden for the creditor or the debtor who's going to be paying for that foreclosure guarantee anyway.
Yeah, Mr. Bell, can I just pursue that point? That, I mean, if I'm following you right, the creditor who's putting pressing forward the foreclosure sale gets a foreclosure guarantee so that they know who the junior lien holders are so that they can meet their legal obligation to give notice to those people. And wouldn't it be at least make sense to at least have that information required to be shared with a judgment with another bidder in the process?
Mr. Chair, that insurance product that's provided to the creditor by the title insurance company is based upon an agreement, a contract between the insurer and the beneficiary of the policy. If that information is shared and third parties then rely upon that policy, again, you may have the potential exposure of the person, the creditor, disclosing the information, and you may have pass-through liability to the insurer.
Okay, I understand the point. And we actually have a title expert in the room, but I don't know that he was intending to share any information, Craig Chisholm. Mr. Chisholm, would it be useful at all for you to comment on that point, or this could be an offline discussion as well? If you think there's something that would be helpful for us to hear right now.
Craig Chisholm, the Oregon Oregon Land Title Association. I'm sort of puzzling over this, actually. I'm trying to figure it out. I guess I'm sort of new to this picture. I understand the issue of trying to get the information about the encumbrances that are prior to the matter being foreclosed. If something's being foreclosed, the juniors basically are going to be wiped out. The seniors, there's a problem. There's a legitimate problem there. I'm trying to puzzle out technically how to do that. We don't have a product like that. I can say that the Oregon title insurance system now has a rating organization, and we can look at those types of problems and maybe address them. That's a possibility, and come up with a better answer than I can give at this time. The concern about the information is a valid concern. The concern about the liability is a valid concern. The concern about the cost, I guess we'd like to have the extra premium, but I'm not sure that's something that society wants to bear. I'm sorry I can't give a better answer.
Well, I don't apologize at all, because I just picked on you. You didn't even sign up.
Mr. Bell was raising another issue, and that is that the dealing in real estate is a complicated issue. If you walk into a process and you buy Blackacre and you haven't checked out the due diligence of the environmental matters, all the things that the brokers, the seller disclosure statements are, and so on, and also whether or not it's a buildable lot and what the zoning, which is a confusing issue in itself, you're walking into a morass. So I'm sorry, I can't give a better answer.
I think what we need to do is to have some discussions after this closure of this hearing to see if we can work on a product that would make sense here. But if we could perhaps access your expertise, that would be very helpful. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming to the hearing. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 345 and open a public hearing. Senate Bill 406. Councilor Thomason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 406A would clarify that the governor has the power to commission humane special agents upon request by a humane investigation agency, and that the governor may, for any reason, decommission or refuse to commission a humane special agent. The bill would define humane special agents to be special agents that are authorized to act as have police powers to enforce the animal welfare laws. It provides that the humane agencies may pay the expenses of and be civilly responsible for the actions of the humane special agents, and it would require the humane agency to contract with the state, and that the contract may contain provisions relating to standards of conduct, indemnification, and insurance.
Okay. We've got quite a few people who are signed up on this bill, and I'd like to hear from... let's get a panel of a couple panels of proponents and then hear from those opposed. Let's bring up Sharon Harmon, Mark Wells, and Jamie Kensky of the Humane Society. Okay, and I would like to finish the public hearing on this by half an hour to 40 minutes from now. So if I'm not going to try to apply time limits as such, but if you could be brief and avoid repetition, that'd be helpful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Sharon Harmon. I am Executive Director of the Oregon Humane Society. I appreciate your desire to wrap this up quickly. A couple of small points to set the framework for this discussion. The Oregon Humane Society has been an organization advocating for the welfare of animals since 1868. We are not affiliated with any other organization, regardless of the name. We all share the common name of Humane Society, but I assure you we are entirely separate governmentally, fiscally, politically, philosophically. Our organization is not an animal rights organization. We are here for the welfare of animals. What the ultimate destination is for that particular creature isn't as important as the care it receives today. I hope that clarifies. It's very confusing. We've not done a good job of marketing or branding ourselves over the last century. I'm here today to ask for your support of Senate Bill 406. This really isn't anything new. We've been operating under an old statute since long before the turn of the previous century. I believe it was in the latter part of the 1800s. We were bestowed the authority to act as peace officers for the purpose of enforcing the animal welfare laws. We had a hand in creating those laws. We created animal protection laws long before there were child protection laws. In our early days, we were child advocates more so than animal advocates, and our role has changed and refined to pretty much dogs and cats and companion animals and pets in need over the years. Senate Bill 406 does little more than clarify that authority in a different statute. And the reason we're here to ask for that is that over time, defendants' attorneys thought they would be clever and say, aha, my client was cited by an unauthorized peace officer, had no authority to bring a case to the district attorney. And that hasn't been the case. We have had that authority. It comes up every time we have a cruelty case by some new defendant's attorney. This does not expand our authority. In fact, it limits our authority. The statute that we are empowered under currently has no limitations on that authority. Senate Bill 406 restricts that authority to the animal welfare laws. The animal welfare laws, I think for Oregon, we have some of the toughest in the country, but they are limited. There are many exemptions for industry, for good animal husbandry practices, for veterinarians, for farmers, for rodeos, for research laboratories. Really what Senate Bill 406 does is says, here's who can do it, And it's a select group of people, the people who have been doing it for the last several years, in our case for over a century. And here's what you can do, and it's narrowed down. It doesn't give any more authority. It doesn't expand powers of arrest. And I think a part that's perhaps surprising is that the Oregon Humane Society doesn't receive any government money. Our $6 million budget is funded by over 50,000 people across the state. Oregonians care about pets. You know that. Anytime an animal issue comes up versus a human issue, you're going to get more calls about it. And we respond to those calls for help. And we're not here to ask for any funds. We pay for the training. We pay for the salaries. We pay for the equipment. We pay for everything associated with these cruelty cases. Our officers work in conjunction with traditional law enforcement officers across the state. We don't go looking for crime. People call us, about 1,000 complaints a year across our desk. Our first choice is to empower local agencies to do the job. There's no way the Redmond Humane Society and the Oregon Humane Society can cover the cases. There are only 4 officers statewide, and we have no such ambitions to take over that responsibility. We're a stronger community if everyone has the tools to do the job. Most often we lend technical assistance. We help agencies understand how to prosecute an animal crime, how to handle animals as evidence. You just can't put them in a locker and wait till it comes to trial. Some examples of how we work with that, sometimes we get cases, we start and finish. Start all the way through, the animal comes into our care if it's still alive, and we assist the district attorney in the prosecution of those crimes. Other times we provide technical assistance, like when Clackamas County seized a number of animals for Virginia Winters, we managed the care of those animals. When Yamhill County seized 10 horses, we were called to say, you now have ownership of 10 horses. We got them to sign them over. That was an expensive case, but to the resolution of all. So in closing, I just wanted to say that there's been lots of talk about this bill. It's really simple. It's just allowing us to do what we do now, refine our authority to the animal laws that are pertinent to our abilities, and to let us continue to provide this service at no cost to the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Harmon. Mr. Wells?
Chairman Pearson, members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about this very important bill. I'm going to cut my statement in half for the essence of time, but as a former municipal police officer here in Oregon, I can attest firsthand that our law enforcement agencies throughout Oregon simply do not have the time, the personnel, or the resources to adequately investigate and enforce complex animal crimes that can often take months, sometimes years, to resolve. Granting limited peace officer status to properly screened and trained humane law enforcement officers employed by humane societies is a concept and strategy of many states throughout the country, and several states have already placed more detail and progressive legislation into law decades ago. It is time for Oregon to recognize the need for professional, humane law enforcement and provide specially designated individuals with the authority and the permanency required to uphold these often neglected laws. Senate Bill 406 will ensure the continued enforcement of these sometimes neglected laws, and I strongly urge your support for this bill. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. Ms. Kansky.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing us to come over from Redmond to talk to you today. We are here in support of Senate Bill 406. I think Sharon said everything very well as far as what our duties and responsibilities and have been. Our program is a little younger than Oregon Humane Society. We've only had the program for about 5 years now. However, it's a program that we created in Central Oregon because of the great need there. Just as Sharon mentioned, our local law enforcement are limited on manpower oftentimes. They don't receive that special training in a lot of animal instances. And we've found that we've been able to collaborate very nicely with all of our law enforcement agencies in both Central and Eastern Oregon. They call our agents on a regular basis to assist with many types of cases, and that's been a great partnership. So some of the areas that we've been able to help with that
have maybe only one or two officers to cover that entire area that they cover. Our Wheeler County, Deschutes County, Jefferson, and also Lake County. And our officers receive quite regular calls for assistance in that. And we're most happy to collaborate and work as an asset and a team member to resolve those cases. Just encourage your support in that. It's very important.
Thank you, Ms. Kansky. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wells, I'll assume that you're one of the four people that Ms. Harmon referenced.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I am. I'm one of three at the Oregon Humane Society.
Can you please tell us what kind of training you have and whether the other three have comparable training?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. I actually have 10 years of law enforcement experience as a federal law enforcement officer and a municipal police officer with the Sherwood Police Department. That's where I received the bulk of my training for this position. We are currently required to attend and graduate the full DPSST Basic Police Academy. After that initial training, which is required for all of our investigators, which they currently all maintain and possess, we then go through additional coursework through nationally recognized programs through the Humane Society of the United States. There are four levels of nationally recognized cruelty investigator school, which we attend. Generally, it's one course per year through the four levels. And all of our staff have the beginning levels of those. We also go through specified investigations in horse abuse and neglect, livestock investigation, and periodically attend regional and nationally accredited humane law enforcement training. All three of us do come from a law enforcement background.
Thank you.
Committee, we've got three more panels to get through on this hearing.
One short one.
If we can be brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Welch, you mentioned the specialized training you received with the Humane Society of the United States. How long is that, and who pays for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, they offer lots of training all throughout the nation. The ones that we have attended most recently are horse neglect and abuse investigations. That is offered. We pay for that. There is a minimal course fee. The nationally recognized cruelty schools are through the University of Missouri. The Humane Society of the United States generally specified courses for example, evidence gathering, collection, or animal-specific type training. And those are usually 1 day to 3 day events.
Okay.
Very brief.
Okay, Representative Barker.
And Dave, if I call, so I call up, I think you've done something wrong. So I call up and say, I want to complain about Officer Wells. Who investigates that complaint, and does the governor who under this bill would authorize, does his office get to know about the complaint, or what would happen?
Currently, Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, currently our policy is that if there's any allegation of misconduct, just we're rude to somebody, or all the way up to an abuse of authority, we violate civil rights, search and seizure, our policy is that that complaint will be forwarded to the local law enforcement jurisdiction. If it's in a city, that's with the police, or in the county with the sheriff's office. That is our internal policy. If somebody has a complaint and wants to know how we are authorized our jurisdiction, then we will let them know that we are commissioned agents of the governor of the state, and that is ultimately who is responsible for our deeds.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to go to a panel of opponents next. We'll hear from Barry Beshu and Katie Fast from the Farm Bureau and Jim Welch from the Cattlemen's.
Good morning. Katie Fast with Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Oregon Farm Bureau opposes Senate Bill 406. On this panel, Barry Beshu is going to talk about some philosophical opposition to the bill, and I'm going to focus on some technical concerns we have with the language. First, the legislation does not require training or qualifications before being commissioned by the governor. You're being heard that that's the current practice. However, the legislation does not have those requirements within it. It also does not specify who will be the oversight agent. And the previous question regarding complaints, I think, is a very good question to be asked. And the legislation should spell out where those complaints would be going to and what agency will be requiring oversight, because we're dealing with criminal code laws that these people will be enforcing, and there needs to be some higher level of accountability for the state government if they're going to be commissioning these agents. The last point I'd like to make is local oversight and control. As these agents move into local bodies and are working in areas where you have a sheriff's office or an animal control office that also has jurisdiction, there should be coordination required within the legislation and also commissioning by the local government, if it's either the county commission or the sheriff's office. There were Dash 1 amendments that came out of a work group that would have had that in the Senate. There were Dash 1 amendments that came out of a work group that Senator Walker chaired, and that would have required local governments to have commissioning authority before these agents were working in different counties throughout the state. Those Dash 1 amendments also took away authority to be carrying weapons. That's another issue that these two organizations strongly oppose. And I will turn over to Barry Bichoux now.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Barry Bichoux. For the record, I'm president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. This is an exceptionally emotional issue, and there's a lot of foundation for protecting the welfare of animals. I don't believe anybody in this room, certainly no thinking member of society in any way, condones animal abuse. The question you folks have to answer as public policymakers is whether this bill is the best way to address the considerable number of cases of animal abuse in the state. I believe that public policy is best served, and one of the most fundamental roles of any government is its ability and its necessity to protect citizens and their rights from others who would abrogate or interfere with those rights. And this is accomplished by our police force. People's faith and trust in the police are based on the kind of people that they are, their training, their commitment to public service, but most importantly, their accountability to their elected supervisors and folks such as yourselves who set the parameters within which those police forces act. This particular bill removes all of that accountability from members of a private police force funded and maintained by a nonprofit volunteer organization with a particular interest in mind. I believe that you have to set aside the idea right now of animal abuse. Perhaps time would be better served in better funding our police forces statewide in being able to deal with these issues. Certainly, the appointment and the lack of accountability in a private police force funded by a group of folks who act in the interests of animals is not the best way to serve public policy. I think the other part of this bill is that it actually excludes any accountability to local law enforcement, to all of those folks in the metro area and Deschutes County, and the only accountability is in the hands of a board of directors of this nonprofit organization. Again, I believe that is unsound public policy. To allow people without the requirements for training, with no accountability, to be out in the public wielding guns seems to me somewhat bizarre. I will make this short. I hope that you folks look at the public policy of this and are not swayed by the emotion of the photos and the types of things you see on the news. That doesn't mean we condone them. That doesn't mean we like them. That doesn't mean we don't want to be acted on them. But I think this is the equivalent of giving Oregon Farm Bureau Federation the right to enter into a contract with the government for us to be the sole means of dealing with theft of metal from our properties and dealing with methamphetamine addicts. It's the equivalent of allowing the Oregon Cattlemen's Association to be the police force in managing the wolf management plan. And if you like those concepts, I would love to have the ability to be a private policeman in a voluntary faction to pull over those people that anger me on the highways when they slow down, cut me off, or whatever. If you like those equivalents, Farm Bureau would be happy to help you develop amendments to make this part of that bill. Otherwise, I strongly urge that you oppose this bill and look at a much better way to serve the public need.
Mr. Welsh.
Chair McPherson and committee members, I'm Jim Welsh here representing the Oregon Cattlemen Association. It's been very well said by President Barry Beauchu with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Completely, and we completely concur with him on that. This is a public policy issue that you really have to wrestle with here. And I guarantee you, just imagine, you know, if someone had it'd been a really ugly and stormy day, and there's a lot of water in one end of a field, and somebody turned in some cattle that were standing, maybe at the first joint in some water, and they were choosing to do that. And then we had humane officers come out there and talk with a cattleman. And they show up in their uniforms, and they're from a private group. And you can imagine how they would probably begin to react if they were not accompanied by a local sheriff's deputy. That is the issue with us. In the Dash ones, we've addressed this. We know that in the three counties in the metro area and Deschutes County, it's been well established with humane special agents. But outside of that, and where the biggest share of our members are, we certainly support our local sheriff's department in taking care of these problems. And our language in this particular bill that we brokered with Senator Walker is what we would support in the Dash Ones. And agents shall have no authority unless commissioned or deputized by sheriffs of those counties. And our sheriff's department is, our sheriff is a locally elected and a constitutional law officer. And those are the law enforcement agencies that we should be supporting and should be handling these animal abuse situations. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Welsh. And that concludes this panel.
I have a question.
Okay.
How do either one of the panel members, Barry or Jim or Kath, how do other states handle this? In other words, to me, it seems like we had a need here that because, as Barry said, we didn't properly fund the police department, people stepped forward. Now, how do other states do this?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, it varies among states, and I probably am not the best person to answer this question, but it is a variance between states. There is a requirement in some states that if these officers go forward, they should be accompanied by local law enforcement as well. I think AFSCME is interested in testifying as well. They might be better suited to answer that question.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Krieger.
Just briefly, Mr. Chair. This morning, about 10 to 6, I had this bill out looking at it, and I had looked at it before. And the bottom, I put down, no oversight by legislator, and that's come up. I put out no accountability. That's come up. And I also put out that citizens should not be subject to nonprofit police. I think this bill actually could be fixed. I had this bill last year, something similar to it when I was chair. And the thing I still object to, I see no reason to have powers of police officers. If they've been doing this right along, when they testified, they never told us why they needed this additional power. They said, we've been doing it. I just don't think we need to go there. I cannot imagine any other nonprofit, let's say the NRA, put on a badge and walk around and start doing search and seizure on private property for some particular purpose. People would be outraged. And I think that's what you're going to see happen in rural Oregon, private forest land and private farmland with cattle and those types of things, livestock.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our next panel will be a panel of those in favoring the bill, Amanda Bjorvik, Jeanette Notgar, and Jackie Beckstead. But unfortunately, in view of time, I'm going to have to hold you to 2 minutes apiece. I'm sorry about that, but we're just running short on time today. Ms. Bjorvik.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to be here today to support the Senate Bill 406. I'm from Powell Butte. I also work for the Humane Society of Redmond, but I also am a cattle rancher. My husband was also a member of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We currently aren't. We are members of the Mid-Oregon Beef Co-op. I can tell you right now that in the 3 years that I have worked there, I have not seen our officers investigate any cattle operation or farm or ranch operation. I think this is being kind of misled. This isn't about search and seizure. This is not about carrying guns. This is about educating our community and our public on the correct care of companion animals. I see them work very well with our law enforcement. We get calls every day from law enforcement asking for help with cases and such like that. I'm very proud of the program that we have going there and respect our officers and very well. They are very highly trained. Yes, the law enforcement can handle these cases, but they don't really want to, and they get put on the back burner, and then we see a small case turn into a really big case, and that is where they come in and help educate. I've seen pictures of when they go in and, you know, they're not handling things correctly. They educate them. They go back in a few weeks. Things are corrected. People are eager to please and want to learn and help in our community. And as we all know, animal abuse and neglect goes hand in hand with domestic abuse. It usually starts there. Law enforcement really picks up with this and works really well together with our law enforcement and officers. So I can guarantee that the cattle ranchers have nothing to worry about. We are very active with our ranch, so I have no need or fear of them interfering with our business. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bjorvik. Ms. Nakbar.
Yes, I'm Officer Nakbar with Washington County Animal Services, and I'm the supervisor for the field officers. I'd like to read into testimony. Dear Representative McPherson and committee members, the Oregon Humane Society currently has limited duty peace officer status that allows them to investigate animal cruelty and neglect. SB 406 continues this. Washington County Animal Services and Washington County as a whole are in support of SB 406. There are many similarities between humane organizations and municipal shelters, but there are inherent differences in the missions of municipal animal control agencies as compared to the missions of humane societies. County animal service organizations are primarily concerned with enforcing county animal codes, whereas Oregon Humane Society looks at issues through Oregon revised statutes. Both agencies desire to limit animal cruelty and neglect, but currently only police officers or humane agents of humane societies have the official authority to investigate. In Washington County, we enforce county ordinances concerning dogs and cats and actively investigate cruelty and neglect issues in livestock, but we do not have the formal authority to issue citations under the ORS. We rely heavily on Oregon Humane Society's investigative team to provide the expertise and support to us that busy police municipalities cannot. It is our opinion that SB 406 should be passed and that limited duty peace officer status should continue to be conveyed upon humane societies within the state of Oregon. We view the Oregon Humane Society investigators as an integral part of our investigative process, and I can unequivocally say that we do not view them as threats to our ability to do our job. They augment our capabilities and provide a resource unmatched in expertise and desire. I strongly urge the approval of SB 407. Sincerely, Gary Hendel, Manager of Animal Services, and that's my supervisor. I'd like to say the primary focus of a humane society is to protect animals. The primary focus of municipal animal control agencies is to protect people. We have different mission statements, and we work greatly in conjunction with those Oregon Humane investigators to do our jobs. We need them. They need us.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Nakbar. Ms. Beckstead.
Yes, hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. I'm Jackie Beckstead. I'm a deputy sheriff in Lincoln County, and the sheriff felt strongly about keeping humane investigators all through the state. So even though I'm the only animal services officer in the whole county, I drove here 2.5 hours to say, please consider keeping humane investigators. They are no competition with union jobs. They are there's no competition that I've ever heard of with deputy sheriffs and the humane investigators. We all work great together. People are our first priority, even though I'm animal services. As she was saying, it's public safety first. And as for the deputies, they are out there taking people calls, and it is the animal calls that are on the back burner. And it's just very much needed. These humane investigators are very well trained. They have great restrictions in here. We would love our budget to kick in three more animal control officers in our county, but that's not going to happen. And you're looking at Humane Oregon, who is funded, paying for everything, paying for training. Yay, bring it on. If I have a big case, that's who I'm going to call to help, is the humane investigators from Oregon Humane. So I just urge you to please think long and hard about keeping these officers. They are very much needed in the whole state, and they do a great job in talking to the community and educating people out there every day. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Beckstein. If there are no questions, then I'll...
Mr. Chair, just real quick. Based on those comments, I'm just curious, if this bill doesn't pass, do all the animal officers in the state of Oregon go away?
Are you talking about animal control officers for a sheriff's office? No, I have my job. They don't affect my job at all, except they help me when I need.
Okay, I wanted to clarify, because it sounded like if we don't pass this bill that they would go away.
The humane investigators...
would go away?
Yes. They would no longer have their authority, so I don't know what you would limit them to if this goes away.
Okay.
Let's
have counsel speak to that here briefly, because I think it's an important point for the committee to understand. Yep.
There is a current statute that allows the governor to commission special agents.
Right.
That statute is still and would still be in effect. So, and that's the authority the governor is using now. So I don't believe that they would go away. I mean, it would still be up to the governor to decide whether to use that statute or not to do this. So he'd have the authority.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our final panel will be Thomas Buckles, Mary Botkin, and Molly Schaefer. And again, with apologies, we're going to have to hold people to 2 minutes. Our last panel was quite good about keeping the remarks in that timeline. Botkin, why don't you start out?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We represent animal control officers who work for county sheriffs. Let me say a couple of things. One, nothing is as emotional as talking about animals. If you haven't figured that out yet, you will by the time this session is over. Everybody cares about injured animals. Everybody cares about neglected and abused animals. This is not a case of my dog's bigger than your dog. We need all the help we can get at every level of animal abuse. The question is not about whether or not the Humane Society does a good job. The question is, who are they responsible to? The citizens and elected officials, or to a volunteer organization with a board of directors that is neither elected nor appointed by anybody who is elected. So one of the things I wanted to show you is right here in my hand, I have 16 bills, all directed at animals. This does not include bills that only address dogs, only address cats, only address horses, only address cattle, only address dairy cows, and only address the evacuation of those animals. It does not include the bills that address the issues of cruelty to service dogs, dogs for the hearing impaired, the blind, and other disabilities. It does not include the bill that I'm working with Representative Witt, to address the fact that a farmer cut out the udders of all the goats on his farm. This is a huge issue. If I have a point that I want to make, my point is we need to have a bigger discussion. We agreed in the House or in the Senate to the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments do not do everything we wanted to do, but they accomplish what people had to have sort of at the table. Once we agreed to those Dash 1 amendments, we got out of the work group, and suddenly the proponents of 406 didn't agree to the Dash 1 amendments anymore after they agreed to them in the work group. I don't know where you go from here. I know that we don't like 406 because it confuses authority. Every sheriff in every county currently has the authority to appoint anybody to enforce the law at any time under a limited scope or forever. The point is, they're responsible. So that would be our point, is that you have an elected sheriff, an elected county commission, and elected judges. There's a clear chain of command. With the Oregon Humane Society, there is not that clear chain of command, and I think it becomes frustrating for people to know where to go and how to get there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Blackfin. Mr. Buckles.
Yes, my name is Tom Buckles, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I have not found the governor overly responsive to my complaints. I have no complaint against the Humane Society. My complaints are the way that the laws are being massaged, tweaked, and ignored. I have something to correct here. This law does not make them give them police powers. It gives them peace officer powers. There is a difference. Under 131.805, the governor is the statute that the governor uses. It says the governor may employ at such salaries as the governor deems reasonable. Are the Humane Society people getting salaries? This authority is, I believe, for public actors, and I think that bears it out. If you look at Act 49, written on 1905, it says the governor is hereby authorized to employ special agents for the apprehension and conviction of criminals. It says that the state treasurer will take a sum of $10,000 for payment of the salaries and expenses of the agents. The Secretary of State will disperse the funds. Then if you look at 1907, here in the bill, it says, for the payment of services, expenses of special agents empowered by the governor for apprehension of criminals, $5,000. We have an Attorney General's opinion, page 616 of 1924, that talks about appropriations have been made by the successive sessions of the legislature for the payments of expenses so incurred. We have what year is this? It's 1931, expenses for, in connection with the employment of special agents, executive department.
Mr. Buckles, it may just break in your
yes, sir. I'm just saying it.
Approaching 2 minutes.
I'm just saying that these special agents are being paid by this legislature. They're not being paid by the Humane Society.
Okay.
In 1931, the governor was given the state police force to replace these special agents, and in 1935, special agents went away.
Yeah, Mr. Buckles, I'm afraid you're out of time, and that's
yep.
A little bit of history.
Can I just...
You have 10 seconds.
10 seconds. Okay, what I have is an application for a search warrant here on the back made by Mr. Wallace. It says Mr. Wallace is a peace officer and eligible to make search warrant requests. Peace officers are not eligible to make requests for search warrants.
Mr. Buckles, you're out of time. I'm
yeah,
sorry.
Well, I'm glad everybody else got more.
Ms. Schaefer.
Hi, I'm Molly Schaefer. I live in Salem, Oregon. I have a USDA licensed facility that I've run for 22 years. I'm here representing the private animal owners. People that raise exotic animals, people that own pet stores, people that are involved in horse shows, dog shows, reptile shows, etc. This bill is actually quite frightening to all of us who are private pet owners. It's rare in the events that we attend these days to not run into radical animal activists at these events. I have been harassed by them. I have a friend who's actually been physically attacked by these people. And again, I'm not associating any of those people with Oregon Humane Society. One real concern I have is in Section 1, it just says Humane Investigation Agency. It doesn't say Oregon Humane Society. A Humane Investigation Agency could be API, it could be HSUS, it could be a number of radical animal, anti-animal groups. It concerns us greatly. The other thing, again, and not to try to be repetitious, but if somebody showed up at my door from the Humane Society without a police officer there, I'm going to have a completely different reaction than if there's a state police officer with that humane officer. I think that the police officers are respected by the public. They're well-trained. again, we've, as people have said, they're responsible to higher authority. And I think to give the what we're calling them as overzealous animal cops powers of a police officer or powers of a peace officer, it's very scary to anybody in the private sector. I think that if there's a problem with funding, perhaps they need to take some of that money and donate it to the state police for training for our state police officers so that they can assist them. The other thing I'd like to point out, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife officers, when they are on wildlife crimes, investigating wildlife crimes, are required to have a state police officer with them. And I feel that the Oregon Humane Society should have the same responsibility.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Schaefer.
Just, if I may ask briefly, say the radical animal cops or something, can you give me an example of that?
Well, currently, as
I mean, it's something that's happened. I mean, you sound like the animal police are doing something.
Schumacher Furs, the perfect example.
What is it?
Well, yeah. Schumacher Furs in Portland has been run out of business.
I'm sorry. Those were protesters. That wasn't humane special agents coming through.
Okay, I'm sorry. I guess I didn't understand your question. As far as a humane agent overstepping their bounds. I personally have not experienced
Thank you.
Okay, that concludes our public testimony on Senate Bill 406. So I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 406 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 248. Council Kelmanson. And just while he's getting papers organized, we have two more bills set for hearing. It's my intention to spend 20 minutes on this bill here and then get to Mr. Boss for the final bill, who's been very patient. But we do want to get the input here on Senate Bill 248. These are both the bill we just heard and this next one are ones that we will not be taking to work session today, but we'll obviously need some more input. Council Cummins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 248A concerns arbitration and non-competition employment agreements. It establishes that employment arbitration and non-competition agreements are void unless A, the employer informs the employee of the agreement's requirements when the offer of employment is first communicated to the employee, or B, the agreement is entered into upon a bona fide advancement of the employee. The bill would establish that non-competition agreements are void if the employee is laid off for any reason other than for just cause. It allows an employer to enforce non-competition agreements if it provides the employee full compensation for the full term of the agreement, or if the employee is a chief executive officer, a chief financial officer, or a member of the board of directors. There was a work group that convened a few days ago to discuss these issues, and a few drafts of amendments were sent around. So to the extent the people testify could talk about those as well, that would be helpful to the committee.
Very good. Commissioner Gardner, let's hear from you first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Senate Bill 248 is actually Senate Bill 616 was rolled into there, which was my bill. And I'll talk about just about quickly about three or four differences there were from the bill you heard here several months ago on non-competes. These have written arbitration and non-compete agreements. Basically, what the concept on this is advance warning that you are expected by an employer to sign one of these prior to employment. So that, in essence, once you're offered a job, you don't move here from Ohio on the first day of your job, and the stack of employment papers is a non-compete agreement and an arbitration agreement. The work group has discussed this on Monday, and we're generally around the consensus of a two-week prior to employment written agreement. Stating a written offer to the employee of the job stating that they have a non-compete agreement or a or an arbitration agreement that they expect them to sign. So we're pretty well wrapped around that. The couple other elements of the bill, this bill says that the non-compete agreement is enforced for 90 days if you're laid off. That's to see if the employer can bring you back or not. It also only allows for just cause dismissal. That's so that you cannot just fire someone in order to keep the non-compete agreement in place. It also addresses a problem that Representative Bonamici brought up in a hearing some time ago that says that client list agreements are fully protected. You cannot, you know, walk away from a business, take someone's client list, and take that business away from your initial business. There's also within the bill a section that says that a non-compete agreement is fully enforced if you are willing to pay 100% of the salary of the employee. Non-compete agreements have ballooned out of control. You've got maid companies. Some of you may have seen in the news a phone solicitation company that went out of business in Beaverton and locked its doors a couple of weeks ago. All 300 of those employees had a non-compete agreement. I've seen lumber companies that have a non-compete agreement that not only allows the employee to work for another lumber company, but not for anyone in the construction industry within a three-state area for a three-year period. Now, with a lot of these agreements, I mean, actually I discovered that the maids who clean my house once every 2 weeks have non-compete agreements. Now, I ask you, what protectable interest could a maid have? Or someone who changes your tire? Or someone who, you know, makes barely better than minimum wage in phone calling on solicitation phone calls. These are out of control. They're unbelievably out of control. While most of them may not be enforceable in a court of law, these are people who don't make enough money to even go see an attorney and find out if they have a case. And if they believe they're enforced, for all practical purposes, they are. And anyway, we have a work group. This bill passed out of the Senate 19-8. We have a work group that's working. We're getting very, very close. I have to commend Nike Corporation on their willingness to work with us. Matter of fact, Nike is one of the best on these agreements. They are very limited in their scope and who they use them on. Those who they lay off, they pay 100% of their base pay for the term of the non-compete. And for those who quit, they pay 50% of their base pay. They are clearly the leader in using these properly. But there are a number of companies that are just absolutely unbelievably out of control in their use of them. With that, I'll keep it very short, Mr. Chair, and answer any questions.
Very good. Any questions for Commissioner Gardner? If not, then thank you, Commissioner, for your waiting until this bill came on for hearing. Let's hear from the contingent from Nike next.
Good morning. I'm Julia Brim-Edwards, Nike State and Public Affairs Director, and I'm here with Peter Curler. Peter's going to be delivering the testimony, and I'm primarily here if there's any sort of process or political questions. Go ahead.
Mr. Curler.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify on this bill. I am the U.S. General Counsel for Nike. As you all know, our global headquarters are here in Oregon. We're a company of 27,000 employees around the globe. But our focus of innovation, research, strategic planning, corporate strategy is here in Oregon. So we have many employees in whom we invest a lot of time and resources in very confidential information in what is a competitive industry. And, of course, it goes without saying Nike is not alone in being a company that invests in innovation in Oregon. From our standpoint, this is a global business climate issue. Our competitors range from Adidas and Puma in Germany, Under Armour in Maryland, Reebok in Massachusetts, and each one of those jurisdictions, to some greater or lesser extent, enforces non-compete agreements. The result of the proposed legislation, if it goes in as it was passed out of the Senate, would be effectively we would lose our right to restrain our employees from going to work for our competitors, but the reverse would not be true. We could not hire employees from our competitors. As Commissioner Gardner noted, we do pay people not to compete. Now, Senate Bill 248 addresses, in our view, a couple of legitimate issues. And we agree that the statute should be tailored to specifically address those legitimate issues. So what are those legitimate issues? Timely notice. And Commissioner Gardner raised that, and I think the work group has come to a good solution on that, that the employee should be timely notified in writing that the terms and conditions of employment include a non-competition agreement. And there is apparently a proliferation of non-competes to hourly, non-technical, non-professional employees. And from a public policy standpoint, that probably needs addressing. So we can support legislation to address these issues, and we're tackling some of those issues in the work group. However, the bill in its current form, we simply cannot support. Among our concerns are these. The ambiguous notice standards, and those are being addressed as we've discussed in the work group. The just cause standard. What that means, and this is really important to understand how non-competes are enforced. The just cause standard would effectively gut non-competes in Oregon. What it would mean is that any time an employer had a non-compete, or any time an employee left that was subject to a non-compete, the employer would go into court. And what happens now is the company asks for a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction to keep the employee from going to work for the competitor. With a just cause standard, there is a huge question of fact that cannot be resolved at the preliminary injunction phase. And every case, or nearly every case, would devolve into a battle that would go the length of the lawsuit all the way through trial to determine whether this was a just cause firing or not. By then, the effect of the non-compete would be meaningless because the employee would have already worked for the competitor for the length of time it took to get to trial. So you're inserting into the statute a factor of what caused the termination, who was at fault, when really that has nothing to do with whether the employee was exposed to company secrets. And the same is true with the layoff standard. The layoff standard and the just cause standard look at the facts and circumstances around the termination rather than what the real issue is here, and that is this an employee who has been exposed to company confidential information? Curiously, the bill in its current form wouldn't necessarily protect low-level workers from having to sign non-competes. Instead, it tries to get it in kind of a backhanded way by looking at the facts and circumstances of the termination rather than at the key issue of what was this employee's job. So the goals of this committee, I would submit, should be to deal with the notice, limit the applicability of the statute to certain kinds of employees, take care of the call center problem, the tire changer, the merrymaids, and additionally, codify Oregon law so that the employer clearly has the burden of showing that it has a protectable interest, which is a term well-defined in Oregon law, so that the information being protected is valuable to the employer and would be detrimental if used against the employer in competition. In order to get at focusing on the right number of the right kind of employees, we support an amendment to the bill which would make non-competes applicable to key employees who are non-exempt as defined by 653.020(2), and that is professionals and executives who perform predominantly intellectual, managerial, or professional work and have access to information to which the employer has a protectable interest. It's a clear, simple delineation that takes care of the call center problem and takes the focus away from the facts and circumstances of the termination. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and either Julia Brynn Edwards or I would be happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Any questions for Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. Have you discussed that statutory standard with the commissioner in the work group, and is that something that everybody's agreed on?
So coming out of the work group the other day, we agreed that we would attempt to draft language around the conversation that we had where it seemed like through the discussion we might have sort of a tentative agreement on the language. There's sort of two different drafts circulating, and I don't know if the committee has access to those drafts, but I think we're narrowing the list of issues that are outstanding. I wouldn't say there's an agreement yet. But we're getting closer, and I think we've narrowed some issues on the protectable interests and the exempt employees.
Thank you.
Recognizing how little time left, we decided to convene a work group in anticipation of this hearing rather than waiting until this hearing was held. I attended that work group meeting here on Monday, but if there's anybody who would like to have access to any of that information or to attend any, if there are subsequent meetings of it, certainly welcome the participation and comments. Any further questions for this Representative Barker?
Maybe I'm jumping the gun here, but we are going to protect. You talked about the executives and all that, which makes a lot of sense. But I talked to somebody about insurance companies, and so you have insurance agents who you might not fall into the non-exempt.
And actually, we have a couple of people from the insurance industry who are signed up.
That are
so
prepared
to
testify
on the
impact.
Thank you.
Company standpoint and our sort of the industry, I think we've laid out language that we think addresses what we believe the legislation is trying to get at, and also recognizing these protectable interests from our industry's perspective.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Curler and Ms. Brim-Edwards. With that introduction about the insurance industry, then Lana Butterfield and Randy Sutton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here representing the professional insurance agents of Oregon, Idaho. They're a statewide group of independent insurance agents. And with me is Randy Sutton, a lawyer here in Salem from Southfield Griggs. I'm going to speak to you about why we believe certain language that was put into Senate Bill 248 is important to independent insurance agents, and then Mr. Sutton will talk to you about the actual contract itself. It's found on page 2, lines 19 through 21, and it specifically addresses non-solicitation or non-piracy agreements, which are a narrower form of non-competition agreements. Independent agents are particularly interested in this because the primary stream of income is based on our customer renewals. And I've given you a chart of why that's important specifically to independent agents. And then the very last page is a letter from a typical insurance agency owner who says he spent over $1 million building his agency. To him, that book of customer business means his retirement. So I'll let Mr. Sutton then talk about the actual contracts that we use.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm a partner with the law firm of Southfield Griggs here in Salem, and I've represented clients on both sides of this, employees and employers, in litigating these, and I've litigated quite a few non-compete cases, and I also draft these agreements. And we do urge you to retain the language that Ms. Butterfield was speaking of with regard to non-solicitation agreements. There's a couple major categories of non-competition agreements out there. One is a geographical restriction where, you know, know, you within a certain geographical territory, you can't compete. The other is a restriction on transacting or soliciting the business, and it doesn't have any geographical restriction. A former employee could leave and set up shop right next door. They just need to stay away from the customers of the agency or the customers of the business that they've left. I think that's a very narrow form of non-compete. I think it's very fair because when somebody is hired, you know, they receive training. They're exposed to the customers, and obviously, when you're hiring an employee, you'd say, you know, I'm going to introduce you to all these customers, and I'm going to pay you to develop my customer base. But you know, the deal we have here is you're not going to take all that from me when you leave. And so, I think it's very fair to exclude what we call non-piracy, which is taking those customers away when you leave. And so, we really like that part of the bill, and we hope that it stays. I wanted to address just briefly one issue on the exempt versus non-exempt that was raised, and Representative Barker addressed this. It is true that outside sales employees are exempt from the wage and hour laws, and outside sales employees must spend nearly all their time outside the office, and truly, you know, kind of their car is their home home office. But inside sales, which is the insurance industry, and really most sales, the sales force for most companies, is a non-exempt employee. I represented a mortgage brokerage at one point in time. The loan officer there was making over $100,000 a year. That person was a non-exempt employee. So the wage and hour laws are set up that way, and certainly I think making a distinction between exempt and non-exempt is not the best way to go about, you know, if you're wanting to skin the cat of, you know, we don't want maids and call center employees subject to non-competes. That's certainly one way to get to that, but I think it's far too broad, and it's going to miss one of the most important areas, which is obviously your sales employees are your visibility to your customer base. And the whole reason you have a non-compete in the first place, because you could just have a trade secret type agreement, the whole reason you have a non-compete agreement is because people are out there. You're paying these people to go develop relationships with the customers. And you all know in your dealings in daily life, you're dealing with a person, not so much with information or with a company. And so if you like the person you're dealing with, you're more likely to follow that person to the next place. And so that's the value of the customer relationship. That's what salespeople do. That's their job. But they're non-exempt employees. So I would encourage you in trying to address that to not use that distinction. And those are my comments. If there's okay. Any questions?
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Sutton. Ms. Butterfield? And last, a panel of Jim Craven and Jack Isselman.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be brief. I know you're heading to floor session. Just 2 seconds of history. We had a hearing on this similar issue, I think it was January or something, in this room. The House committee did not take action on this issue. The Senate committee had a parallel bill, and this bill did come out of the Senate Commerce Committee. Some of the issues that the Nike panel addressed about just cause and such were inserted in the bill really at the, you know, right before the work session. We know how this all works and really didn't have much chance to comment on those prior to them being adopted. But that's not unusual this time of session. I'm going to cut to the chase and say I pretty much agree with everything that was said by the Nike panel. I agree with those positions. I think, you know, I commend the Commissioner of Labor for bringing this issue to the fore, and I think we have identified clearly two issues here. One is if it's true that these are being widely applied to maids and tire changers and stuff, that's probably wrong. That represents, I think, lazy employers, maybe even lazy attorneys, who instead of focusing on what really needs to be protected to the company, blanketly take a form off of the internet and have people sign it. So I think we have a solution to that. I am very sensitive to the concerns of the insurance industry about whether we've hit it right with exempt, non-exempt. Maybe there's a potential way to address the issue of inside sales specifically. We're going to work on this more today, I think. But I think that issue of saying, let's find a way, rather than focusing on how a person leaves the firm, as the Nike representative mentioned, let's focus on narrowing the use of these altogether to and get rid of inappropriate uses of non-competes while companies with their high-level people who have very sensitive information still can use this tool because we think it's valuable. And the second issue that has clearly arisen is making sure that nobody gets surprised with a non-compete or an arbitration agreement the day they show up to work. And we're very supportive of the adequate advance notice, 2 weeks notice. We're working on language for that. So we think there are really two clear issues that we all agree upon, and I think we can write amendments to address them. There are other issues and wrinkles that do make us nervous in this latter part of the session of trying to solve things with language that we don't just clearly have time to vet with the whole employment community, employment labor law community. If we can address the two narrow issues that I think we can come to agreement on, I think there's a commitment by a lot of people to continue this dialogue after adjournment, and look at some of the bigger picture issues and maybe some more fundamental fixes that need some more time to be addressed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Esselman, if you
Chair McPherson, for the record, Jack Esselman of Tonkin Torp. I'm the incoming chair of the Lazy Attorneys Association of Oregon, so I'm actually here representing the Software Association of Oregon, so I won't take on Mr. Craven's comments directly. But we generally are in alignment with what the Nike panel told you. We agree the notice needs to be worked on. We agree, we share the concern about the proliferation of these agreements to non-exempt workers and other workers without a protectable interest. Finally, just to put a final point on it, termination should not be the operative criteria for whether or not these types of, the manner of termination should not be the operative criteria for the enforceability of these agreements. And I'd raise a caveat to the committee, which is somewhat next to the point, but I think important to consider. The unintended consequence of creating a statutory definition for a layoff and possible repercussions that could cause either in other statutory law or at common law. We think there's a better approach. We're working in the work group to achieve that, and I think we're optimistic we can get a favorable result. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Esselman. That concludes our hearing on Senate Bill 248A. I'll close that public hearing. I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 119A and invite Mr. Bossa. We have just a couple of minutes here, committee, and so it was at least to get the subject matter introduced. Council Kamenson, why don't you tell us very briefly about the bill, and we'll just see how much more we need to learn about this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Very briefly, Senate Bill 119A establishes that the Attorney General may investigate and enforce violations of the Oregon Securities Law. It requires notice to the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services and consent in certain instances, and permits fines up to $20,000 for each violation, plus awards of attorney's fees, damages, restitution, disgorgement of legal profits, and appointment of a receiver.
Okay, Mr. Boss, and depending on how much you think we need to learn, how much the committee feels they need to absorb, we can certainly roll over a work session to another day, but I thought I'd at least get it opened up and introduce the issue, and you could tell us just a little bit about it.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Fred Boss. I am the Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify today in support of Bill 119A engrossed. I do have written comments. The Senate Bill 119 is proposed by the Oregon Department of Justice, and it would allow the Oregon Department of Justice to enforce the Oregon securities laws in two very narrow circumstances. The bill would allow the Department of Justice to investigate and prosecute Oregon securities law violations where there are alleged violations involving companies whose securities are nationally registered. The genesis of this bill actually comes from our investigation, a combined joint investigation that we had with the Department of Consumer and Business Services in the wake of the Enron collapse. And from that investigation, we discovered much to both of the agencies' surprise that no Oregon agency or entity really had authority to investigate and prosecute securities laws in that instance. In addition, so that's the first very narrow circumstance to be those companies. The second is that in our financial fraud and consumer protection section does go and investigate investigates entities for violations of the Unfair Trade Practices Act or antitrust or racketeering laws. And in many of those scams that we are investigating, such as pyramid schemes, there may be also an investigation or also a violation of the Oregon securities laws. And we might be able to leverage our investigation activities with that of the of DCBS in order to get a resolution of all those types of investigations. So the other narrow circumstance is the when the Department of Justice is in those three areas investigating activities, they would then go back to the Department of DCBS. Tell them of the investigation, allow them an opportunity to either take over the investigation themselves, have a joint investigation and prosecution, or turn it over to the Attorney General to do continue forward with the investigation and prosecution.
Well, committee, we're out of time. We're due on the floor here now. So although I think this is a pretty straightforward bill, my inclination is to close the public hearing and roll over the work session so we have a little bit of time to discuss it. So what I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 119. That concludes our agenda. And just to remind people, we are rolling over the work sessions on all the bills that were noticed for today. That is Senate Bills 279, 347A, 629A, 119A, 248A, 345A, and 406A. Those are all rolled over for work session noticed on I think already noticed for Tuesday, the 29th of May. With that, our meeting is adjourned.